Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Having just finished a very short retreat, there are becomes so clear to one just how important solitude is for the practice of the Buddha Dharma. This solitude is not just physical solitude, but also the mental solitude. Solitude, like being alone, being at one, centered inside rather than sending the mind outside. It starts with physical solitude because the world pulls you out so much. It draws you with its problems. It's just so hard and difficult to try and avoid or escape from the responsibilities and the problems of life. This world outside is a very sticky place, and very few people have the strength or the wisdom and the skill to avoid those problems and distractions. All of you who have had the merit to become monks should feel very grateful and very fortunate indeed to have at least a greater chance than many to avoid the entrapments of the world. You have a chance, a marvelous chance, which isn't afforded to many people in this world. Just to notice that when one just goes into one's hut rather than comes outside and deals with people and with problems and difficulties and things which come up, just how much more energy there is and how all of that energy can be focused on the goal rather than having to be shared with just running a place, we're dealing with other people's problems, we're sorting out the day-to-day business of the external world. And noticing just the difference when one is secluded, isolated, when one can shut the door to those problems, one just realizes what is required in order to attain that which we aspire to. To achieve the goal of this Buddhist practice. And any of you who have tasted or even glimpsed that goal just know what a beautiful and powerful and marvelous and deep and profound fruit that is, you know, the fruit of liberation. This is the Buddha said somewhere, that better than like power over the whole world, better than all the wealth and the power of kingdoms, which in the time of the Buddha was, you know, what few people could only hope to achieve and what everyone would aspire to, power, control, to get what one wants, to arrange the world so one can only get happiness. Better than all of that is just the enjoyment of the first path and fruit. Just to actually know these things and to realize that this is the highest, this is the most sweetest, most profound happiness that there is. And this is what it takes. It takes like this solitude. But the physical solitude, again, is not enough. Because you find that some monks, some people, they have the opportunity for solitude and they waste it. They waste it because of the power of the defilements, what we call in Buddhism, the asavas. This is like the mind streaming out to the world outside. It's good to know what we call the mind, the citta, as like an experience inside, as to actually experience a citta, to know it very well, as like a thing in itself, It's impermanent, it's a stream, it's flowing, but one can give it a name, a designation, in order that one can know it very well. And to see the way that this citta, because of its defilements, the asavas, the outflowings, it goes out to the world and seeks for disturbances. It's a perverse thing, these defilements. It's stupid, it's full of ignorance and delusion, because it creates so much dukkha for itself. There is a chance, there is the opportunity. There's nothing for you to do in the monastery. There is nothing for you, no responsibilities and duties, nothing to do at all. We go out seeking one another's company, talking to one another, disturbing one another. Or if someone disturbs you, we take that and we allow ourselves to be disturbed. We send the mind out to the world outside, the world of the five senses, and we allow the mind to be taken away from its solitude. That's why, in order to develop both jhana and true insight, one has to develop the love of solitude. The mind which tends towards that solitude, which goes towards it, which actually avoids getting involved, which avoids conversations, which avoids business. And it's not that one is being lazy or irresponsible, because the wise Dhamma practitioner, monk or lay person, realizes that this is the highest goal and what they should really be putting all their attention and effort and everything pushing towards that goal, the highest goal. And if ever there is a feeling that, well, what about compassion and help for other people, one should always realize and understand that that achievement is the most compassionate thing one can do for other people. To achieve the path and fruit, to achieve the liberation of the mind, to achieve that great wisdom which the Buddha achieved, so that one can share it and impart it to others, so that they too can follow and also achieve that great bliss of release, renunciation, of freedom from dukkha, from suffering. So the greatest, most compassionate thing one can do in this world is to become liberated for oneself. And realizing that one should develop the love of solitude, the love of allowing the attention to dwell within, to turning it within, rather than to turning it outside. Just developing that love, that tendency in the mind, that direction of the mind, makes this whole practice so much easier. In this particular monastery, for the last few years, we have built the monastery, we have developed the monastery, we've set up the facilities and made the mood hopefully conducive to developing that inner solitude. But when one has got that physical solitude and that inner solitude, quite often one will find the mind going out to the past, the future, to fantasies, to dreams, to plans, disturbing itself to no apparent reason. And why, if one searches and looks for the reason, why is it that the mind does not remain still? Why is it that the mind cannot really settle in on itself, to really know itself so clearly that it can liberate itself from the delusion of thinking that itself is a soul, a self, a permanent entity? Why is it? It's because of these things which the Buddha called the asavas, the outflowings of the mind. It's a mind which has this interest in things outside of itself. It is a mind which will do anything to escape from being investigated. A mind which will take on causes outside, will plan, will make thinking that there, in the outside world, there can be happiness, there can be freedom, there can be satisfaction and contentment. Hopefully all of us by now have had enough experience of the outside world, to know that there is not where true contentment, peace, freedom, liberation lie, that indeed there cannot be any true satisfaction or contentment there. This outside world is continually crumbling away, continually falling, continually changing, so much so that it's like trying to stand on the ocean, always sinking, never a solid place to stand to get one's footing, always falling, always changing. Wherever can one build any happiness there? So the wise practitioner knows that it's there in the mind, turning within, looking within, accustoming oneself to staying within, is where that true peace and liberation can be found. But these outflowings of the mind are very strong, are ingrained, they've been developed over many lifetimes. And it's very difficult to overcome them. And I was reading just one of the last of the suttas I read, just happened to be the Sabbasava Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the second sutta there. And just reading that was a very simple sutta where the Buddha was describing just how these outflowings, these asavas, how they are tamed, how they're overcome, how the one gets to be free from this mind which is always searching for something else outside of itself, which cannot stay still with itself long enough to be free and to be liberated. Because it's only when the attention can stay deep within oneself to this mind, that one knows it so well, that one realizes that there's no self there, that it's always changing, that it's unsatisfying, that it's a process, a changing process, an empty process, so much so that one can let it go, fully let it go, to the point where there's freedom, where there's freedom from the attachment there, which keeps one worrying about this mind, worrying about the objects of the mind. There is freedom there. We need to know and be with that mind for a long time to know it so well before that freedom can appear and we can realize the relief from the burden. And in that sutta, the Sabbasava Sutta, the Buddha was saying that there's, I think if I remember correctly, seven ways by which the defilements or the asavas, the outflowings, are subdued. And it's interesting to know that these seven different ways, because sometimes that the outflowings, the defilements which take us away from our centre, sometimes that we need to practice one way and the other ways won't work, depending on what the defilements are. Unless we know what tool, what medicine to use, the sickness won't abate. And we can sit in our hut, we can practice meditation and never get anywhere. The mind always going away rather than staying within itself. And just recording now the Sabbasava Sutta, the first way in which the defilements are overcome, the asavas are overcome, is like through insight, through seeing clearly. Through what is called dasana, through seeing. And this particularly, this aspect of seeing is achieved through this practice of yonisamanisikara, which I've mentioned in every other talk it seems, or even more often than that, almost every talk during this rains retreat. It's very like important and beautiful word in Buddhism, that the work of the mind which goes back to its source, that right attention which seeks the reason, the source, the cause of things, which goes to the root of the problem, which goes inwards, deep, rather than outwards, if you can imagine a sphere, the asavas are what go out from that sphere, out into the world outside. Yonisamanasikara goes in the opposite direction. It goes to the center of things, the core, the essence, the pith. And it's that development of a mind which seeks for the cause of things, which goes into the center of things, which goes to the womb of all the mind's creations. That's where one gets insight into the nature of the mind. When one knows the nature of the mind, one knows the nature of the world. And that work of the mind which goes back to its source, which goes inwards rather than outwards, needs to be developed. It is a work of the mind which uses thought, which directs thought, but it's thought which is directed inwards rather than outwards. It's not like a papancha, this conceptual proliferation, which is thought going outwards onto things. It is thought which goes inwards, which gets more simple the deeper it gets, which gets more concentrated, more close to the root and the core of the problem of dukkha. Go to that one thing which the Buddha discovered and taught in manifold ways. In this particular aspect, the Dhamma is one. It's one realization. Whether one calls it anatta, anicca, or dukkha, it's all the same one thing, the nature of the mind, the nature of existence, to uncover that, discover that. And this is what is the asava which is overcome through this clear seeing, by looking inwards rather than outwards. And you'll find that most of the problems in this world arise when we use thought outwards, when we go out to the things rather than looking inwards to the cause. There's two directions there. One leads to freedom, the other leads to more complications, more entanglements. That is the first way that the asavas can be overcome, and in particular through that practice of searching for the source, the core of the problem, we overcome those first three defilements, or first three sanyojanas rather, the first three fetters, which are the obstructions to being a stream enterer. The sakkaya ditti, the view of a self, the silabhata paramasa, the attachment to the view that through rites and rituals or through morality and observances that one can become free and liberated, and through the doubting mind which hasn't really seen the path and so is not sure of which way to go. These three defilements which stop one being a stream enterer. And in particular the sakkaya ditti, the view of a self which is very deeply ingrained in the human being, that can only be overcome once that yonisamanasikara goes right to the very center of that which we take to be a self. It's a looking inwards, pushing the mind closer and closer inwards. And there'll be a resistance there from the idea of self, from the ego. And so it takes a lot of energy, power, courage, to go that deep, to uncover the source of the problem. The idea of a self is not a simple thing. It's very profound to go that deep. You go so deep, go deeper and deeper and deeper until those three defilements, those three fetters, as it were, explode. Explode and shatter, never to be put together again. And to have that realization, that dawning of stream enterer. And these realizations, these path and fruit moments, I've said before, are very clear. But one knows when these things happen. So much so that there is, I remember reading in the commentaries, that this is in a commentary to the Vinaya, the Samantabhasadika by Buddhaghosa. Even though this has Buddhaghosa as the author. He was editing previous commentaries, some of which went back a long, long, long way, and were probably started at the time of the Buddha or just afterwards. So even though this commentary, which we call the Samantabhasadaka, was written 1,000 years after the Buddha passed away, it does contain much earlier material, much, much earlier material. And this particular passage, if I remember correctly, is just on the commentary to the fourth Paratika about a monk who claims attainments or supernormal powers. He's saying if any monk does claim any of the paths and fruits, in order to find out whether he is being truthful or not, there are certain questions which you should ask him. And these are little, the commentary points out here that the questions you should ask someone who claims to have experienced Magga and Pala. And if he can't answer these questions, then you know that his attainment is just a delusion. And one of the questions there, a couple of them, was exactly when, exactly where, the time and the place. Saying that if you can't answer clearly, then you've obviously haven't got that attainment. But this is the way that particular attainment is achieved, through that yonisamanasikara. So that attention, that work of the mind, which goes back to the source of things, which goes in, and you can see it's going against the asavas. Just as in the story of the Buddha, the way, just before he became enlightened, they have the simile of him floating his bowl in the stream and the bowl going against the current, going upstream, and saying that that was the way, that was a simile to the process which we need to do, the way we need to go if we wish to become enlightened. We need to go against the stream, to go against the asavas. The asavas take us outside, they're outflowings, going away from the core of the problem. We need to go in the opposite direction. We need to swim upstream against the current. That's hard work. But that's the only way these defilements are overcome. You'll find that going upstream there'll be eddies, and we'll find ourselves turned around, unable to resist the flow of the asavas. We need to just turn ourselves around again and swim back upstream, continually trying till we get to the source of that stream, the idea of a self, the delusion of a self. That's the first way the Buddha said the asavas, or some of the asavas, are overcome, through yonisamanasikara, the work of the mind which goes back to its source. The second way the asavas are overcome in this Sabbasava Sutta is through sense restraint. And again, if one is practicing meditation, if one hopes to achieve jhana, or if one hopes to achieve magga and pala, the sotapanna and above, sense restraint is so important. Sense restraint is both the path and the fruit of someone who's practicing either samatha or vipassana, is practicing for calmness of the mind or for insight. It's a path because without restraining the mind, without restraining the five senses, without taming these asavas by this simple restraint, these asavas, these outflowings, will have so much power, we'll never be able to sit still long enough. We'll never be able to concentrate on the breath long enough. When the mental sign, the nimitta of jhana appears, we'll never be able to stay with it. The asavas will flow us out, will flush us out. The closer you get, the faster and stronger the stream is, pushing you away from that inner, close center of peace and quiet. We need to tame those asavas. We need to gain strength. And this is one way which we can prepare ourselves in daily life. Sometimes the people write books about how to practice Buddhism in daily life. If I wrote a book about how to practice Buddhism in daily life, you'd just have 6 chapters, each one on the restraint of each of the 6 senses. Because that's the only way you can practice Buddhism in daily life, by restraining those senses. Restraining the eye, restraining the ear, the nose, taste, touch, and especially the mind. Each one needs to be held back. It needs to be held back with the help of mindfulness, which knows exactly what's going on, and which has enough wisdom with it to know that if one allows the senses to operate unguarded, unchecked, uncontrolled, just the mind will get hot, it will get upset and angry, it will get troubled, it will get anxious, it will get restless. Because that's the nature of the world outside. It's attractive or it's repulsive, and it takes the mind out. We play around with it. We get nowhere in the end. But there is the realm of the asavas. We need to check ourselves. And the way of sense restraint, which hopefully everyone should know, is that, just as it says in the suttas, as every wise monk explains, just for example, just taking the eye, which is perhaps one of the most important of the 5 senses. Certainly it's probably the sense which our attention stays with most of the time. That with the eye, if there is an object one is seeing, one should be careful. It's as if there's bait, just like a person fishing puts bait on the end of the hook and dangles it in front of the fish. There the fish is your mind. And it's the bait is there, which can make you angry or which can entrap you with desire and lust and I want. There is always that aspect in the world of the 5 senses, that which is desirable and attractive and that which is repulsive in everything. The trouble is that the mind just sees one part and sees the attractive and just ignores or disregards the unattractive. Or it does the opposite. It picks and gets a false, not a full view of the reality. And once there is desire or aversion there, there comes craving, there comes attachment. One has taken the bait and one is caught up in the world of form, beautiful sights or ugly sights. Beautiful sounds, praise, or someone being angry and abusing you. We take the bait. That's why we need to restrain and be very careful. The world of the 5 senses is like a snake. It bites. But a lot of us don't know how poisonous this snake is, so we play with it. We get bitten. So we need to restrain the 5 senses. If you haven't restrained the 5 senses and you sit meditation, you'll find it's very difficult to remain still. If you haven't restrained the 6th sense, the mind, you'll find that all sorts of plans and memories and fantasies and thoughts will keep running through your mind. Why? Because they were there before. It's just the current continuing, the momentum carrying on. So that's why that Buddhism in daily life, the practice in the monastery, whether one is eating, whether one is walking, talking, whatever one is doing, one should always remember sense restraint. Restraining those senses weakens the asavas. And you just notice that, especially if you do a retreat and you actually stay inside your hut and don't go more than a few meters outside the hut, just on your walking track, the senses get restrained so much. There's nothing to see, you don't hear things, you don't talk to people. The senses get restrained so much, there's hardly any disturbances to them. It becomes very easy to concentrate the mind. if you're having still difficulty with gaining jhana, try sense restraint. Restrain each of those senses as much as you can, and make that your main path for the next few weeks. Sense restraint, sense restraint. And especially the restraint of the mind. To be able to say no to the mind whenever a thought, an idea, a mental object comes up, not to take the bait. All of these thoughts and imaginings which go on in the mind, you should have enough wisdom to know they're not real. That they're only a projection of reality. They're only like an image, like a Hollywood movie. It's not real, it's not what happens in real life, the thoughts which go on through your mind. Doubt those thoughts, question them. Whatever thought you have, whatever desire or plan, is it really going to be that way? Is that what it was really like? Is this what it's going to be like? And you notice that the world of thought is a very poor image, a poor reflection of the real world. It's not accurate, it's not real. That's a very good understanding and insight to know that, as the Buddha said, whatever you think it will be something else. That the inaccurate representation of the world that thought really is. And it takes a lot of importance away from thinking. It takes a lot of energy away from that mind which is always planning, making notes, talking to itself, on and on. Doubt that thinking mind, and then it becomes easy to restrain. You can say no to it and it stops. The mind doesn't think so much. Again, in one of the suttas which I was reading in the retreat, if any of you are going on a retreat, I would recommend the reading of suttas. They both inspire, they give one joy, and they also turn one in the right direction. They actually assist the attainment of these wonderful states of mind. And in this particular sutta, Buddha was talking about the Santo Muni. Actually, that might be a nice name for the next person who becomes a monk here. Santa, the peaceful sage. Santo Muni. And this was a person who just doesn't get caught up in thinking and imaginings, in the mind which is always proliferating in thought and seeing the whole world as thought rather than as experience. And he said such a person is so close to Nibbana, and such a person will eventually very easily just reach the end of birth, old age and death, and they will not be will not tremble and will not have desire. But certainly we can all like know that thinking mind, that imagining mind, and don't believe in it. If someone has upset you, then just know that this is just imaginings. You can just look at those thoughts running through your mind. If you don't believe in them, it's very easy to stop them. If you really do believe in them and think this is real, that person really did that, they shouldn't have done that, this is not right, this shouldn't be this way. If you think that way, it will really disturb you. You have taken the bait, you hadn't restrained the mind. I know many monks who can restrain the five senses, but who don't restrain their mind. Who think and plan, fantasize. Such monks are missing the great opportunity. Restrain the six senses, and then you will achieve some sense of peace. And certainly when one practices jhana, one is really taking the restraint of the six senses to very profound and deep levels. One is restraining the five senses first of all so much one turns them off completely. One is not taking any notice at all of sights, sounds, tastes, smells or touches. Just leave them alone. Don't get involved in them. say no. When you sit meditation, there'll always be something to disturb you. You'll never get absolute quiet. You'll never get absolute comfort of the body. There'll always be some ache, itch, pain to disturb you. And that's why the only way you achieve success in jhana meditation is not getting the perfect place. It's not getting it absolutely quiet. It's not getting just the right food so you don't have indigestion. It's not getting just no noise and the most comfortable design chair to sit on. The only way you can achieve jhana is to sit down and, if you don't mind me saying, to hell with the pain and the noise, I'm not going to listen to it. Just remember in Ajahn Chah's biography, one of the most profound meditations he had was when there was a party on at the village. And those of you who have lived in Thailand who know when they have a party on in the village, their loudspeakers just are so loud that they'd be much louder than if you had a radio in your kuti and you turn it on full volume. It's really loud when they play their music. You can hear it a few villages away. And Ajahn Chah, he gained one of his most profound experiences at a time when there was such a party on in the nearest village, and there was music just blasting through his ears. But he had a peaceful mind, and he could let that go or discard it. And I just know in my own practice that very often there's been noise outside, disturbances, bangs, shouts, and you've been managed to say no to all of those things, to restrain the mind, restrain the senses, and just disregard those things and get into peaceful states of mind, to turn off those five senses. That is the way you gain peace, not by arranging the outside world, but by practicing that degree of restraint which turns off the switches. So you don't see, hear, taste, touch or smell. That's the way one gains at jhana. So one, don't get involved with the situation outside. We set it up reasonably well, it's good enough. In fact it's pretty good in this monastery. Now all one needs to do is just to say no to the minor disturbances and then center on the mind. And then say no to the disturbances of the mind. To remember that jhana meditation is a quietening and a quelling of the mind and of the other senses. It's samatha, it's tranquilizing, making things peaceful, slowing them down, stopping them, turning off all of the activity more and more and more. And as the activity of the mind, and again those activities are called asavas, they are things which take you out of yourself, which make you flow out and take you away from the source of things, the heart of the mind. And we have to turn off those outflowings. And that's what restraint is, sangwara. And that's the second way that the asavas can be lessened or eventually eliminated. The third way is to, I think it's patisewana, which means that through following certain courses, there's certain things which we need, this is like restraint, there's certain things we need to take up and use. In particular in the sutta they say that it's just like, you know, we have to use our food, we have to use robes, we have to use these things. And the way to achieve like jhana or magampala is not through giving up the use of these things. Fasting can be all right, but be careful about fasting, because the highest practice with food is not to give up food altogether, but to be able to use it wisely. Because The body does need energy to get into jhanas. It does need to be balanced physically to be able to achieve these deep states. And that's why, I mean, the Buddha tried fasting and he did not get very far. It's only when he got the milk rice from Sujata and had a feed, had a meal, that his body had the energy, had the balance that could enable him to launch off into the jhanas. So we need to use these things, but use them wisely. And the way we use them wisely is to remember what their purpose is. The purpose of food and robes and lodgings is just to give us enough to be able to meditate, gain jhana, reflect on the Dhamma. No more than that. These things will never be perfect. You'll never get the perfect food, the perfect hut, the perfect monastery. That's not the point. The point is just reflecting that these things have a purpose and it's good enough. Indeed, the next of the ways of overcoming the asavas, I mean, it comes as a pair with maybe with the use, which is like the endurance. This endurance is also extremely important if we wish to overcome some of the asavas. We need to have this strength which can endure unpleasantness, discomfort, because again the body and the mind will never be just right. There'll always be some sort of problem, some physical ailment. The world outside will never be satisfying. And there comes a time where we say, so what? That even though my legs are aching, I feel tired, I'm going to sit meditation. I'm not going to bother about these things. If one hasn't got endurance, the difficulties and problems and discomforts of the body and of life in general will again take you away. You will flow out trying to solve those problems and discomforts. And you know what happens when you flow out trying to solve the problems and discomforts? The problems and discomforts just get more, they get more complicated. In Thailand, you used to have problems with mosquitoes. I mean, in Thailand, when I was meditating, I used to dream about living in a place where there was no mosquitoes. Just how wonderful it would be to meditate when you didn't have mosquitoes. Okay, you had a mosquito net, they always used to get in there somewhere. You had screens on the hut, they still used to get in through the floorboards or somewhere. There's always problems with mosquitoes in those countries. And I used to think, what a wonderful thing it would be to be... I heard once that, I think it was my second rains retreat, there was a little monastery in Thailand, in central Thailand, where they said there were no mosquitoes. It was in a teak forest, just north of Saraburi, on the edge of the northeast of Thailand. And there was winds there, it was quite high up, and there's winds there and it blew all the mosquitoes away because the mosquitoes didn't like winds. And as soon as I heard about that, I wanted to go there straight away. Oh, the bliss of being able to meditate without having the mosquitoes disturbing you all the time. But it wasn't necessary. Even though Ajahn Chah could meditate in a place, even though there was a party going on nearby, you soon learned as a monk in Thailand to meditate even though the mosquitoes were biting you, even though your legs were aching, even though it was hot and sticky. Even sometimes you learn how to meditate when you had a fever. You develop this endurance, which could even know that the physical body was hurting, was in discomfort, you could say, so what? And just go on into the mind and make the mind very peaceful and quiet and calm and leave aside the physical body. Again, those discomforts can be a great source of asavas, of outflowings of the mind. And of course, I'm not saying that one should neglect the body, but there comes a time when one says, enough, I've done enough to try and get my body comfortable. I know it's not going to be perfect. Now is a time for endurance. Now is a time to sort of say, okay, I'm going to meditate in spite of the ache, the pain, the difficulties and the problems. And that endurance is a very important way to overcome the outflowings of the mind. And again, if you wish to achieve jhana, you have to have built up quite a large degree of endurance. I remember once going to Ajahn Sawat's monastery in Thamsigaw in Phupan in Thailand. Ajahn Sawat is a disciple of one of the Thai forest teachers, Ajahn Phan, who was extremely highly regarded. And I remember just, I only went to his monastery for a few days on my year when I was wandering. I remember going into the sala there for the evening meeting and seeing him sort of sit on the Dhamma chair and sit for 2 hours and saw the sweat pouring off him. And after having sat for that long, all I remember of his talk was saying, if you want to achieve samadhi, this is a sort of effort you need to put in. And it's quite obvious that, I don't know whether he was sick or whether he just had a busy day, but that guy was really, sorry, that very wonderful monk was really trying, and he was really putting forth effort and endurance, and he achieved things. You achieve something through that strictness and that toughness of the mind. Unfortunately, that is necessary if one wishes to attain jhana, if one wishes to attain magna-pala, to practice that endurance which gives strength to the mind. So that's one of the other ways which one overcomes the asavas. There's another, the next way is through like avoidance. We have to like avoid things which can unsettle us. Avoid conversations, avoid talking with lay people, avoid that which we know we'll get caught up in, will send us out, and will stop our mind being peaceful. I mean, what happens when we get into a conversation after the meal? What happens when we go and do things which we know we shouldn't do, go to places we know we shouldn't go? It creates a disturbance for the mind. And so, as a person who's dedicated to practicing to achieve jhana or achieve magna-pala, we should know that it's important to avoid those situations where we know the mind is weak and vulnerable and will be taken out of itself. And so that avoidance is also a way of weakening the asavas, weakening these outflowings of the mind. In other words, like going back to the simile of like a stream or a river, we avoid those parts of the stream where the current is very strong, where we know we really haven't got the strength to swim against it. We know those parts of the stream where the currents are not that strong, and there we can do our swimming. Be careful of the middle of the stream where the current flows very fast. You will just get swept along. So we have this avoidance of those places where we get caught up, which create problems and disturbances and problems and difficulties and troubles. And be honest with yourself, because sometimes we think that, oh, I can handle this. I can be mindful, it doesn't really matter. I know many monks who have disrobed because they've had that attitude, because they thought they could handle difficult situations, they could swim in the middle of the stream, but in truth they didn't really have the strength yet. Avoidance. Then the sixth way of overcoming the asavas is perhaps the most important. It's through something which is in Pali we know deity, literally translated as driving them out. There does come a time when we exert power, when we say to the defilements, those outflowings of the mind, no, I'm not going to live with you, I'm not going to stay with you, get out. That strength of mind, that ability of the mind to repel, to drive away, to drive out, again is very helpful and useful in the practice. It is the sixth way mentioned in the Sabhasava Sutta in which a monk relinquishes or abandons the asavas through driving them out. Sometimes we try all these other ways to stop the mind going out of itself, to stop the mind getting caught up in the world, and sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes we just have to be strict and tough with ourselves and just say, no, I'm not going to stand those fantasies any longer. I'm not going to stand that planning mind any longer. Mind, you're going to sit down here, and no matter what, I'm going to sit here for 2 hours. No matter how much pain it is, enough. We have that ability, that strength of mind to drive out asavas. In particular, in the Sabhasava Sutra, it says you drive out 3 things, karma vitaka, vyapada vitaka, and vihingsa vitaka. I call it vitaka, my pronunciation has gone off. It's vitaka, thought. Karma vitaka is like thought concerned with the sensual world. And it's like thoughts which are not just with that which is desirable in the sensory world, but which is caught up with that which is desirable. Plans, even thoughts about your relatives, if you're a monk, thoughts about your monastery, if you're a layperson, thoughts about your home. All of these thoughts which are concerned with the outside world. Sometimes they can come up in the meditation and they can drive us crazy. Sometimes we can spend a half an hour, 2 hours just thinking about stupid things. Karma vitaka. We need to sometimes drive those things out to say no, shut up, stop. If we're forceful enough and confident enough, we can do such things. And we can shut off that stream right in the middle. No. And it can work. It can be done. Driving it out. The other two, karma vitaka is one of them. The other two, vyapada vitaka, is the thoughts concerned with ill will towards a person, towards a being, animal or whatever. And vihingsa vitaka is going further than just mere ill will, but actually wishing them harm, wishing them injury. And these are like thoughts which can oppress the mind. And again, they take us away. They take us out into the world. That person, they did this, they said that, they shouldn't have done that. They're messing up my meditation, they're messing up my retreat. They shouldn't be here. They did this, they did that. Again, it's taking us away from the center of our mind, outside. Sometimes we need to say no, shut up. To drive that asava, that movement of the mind, out of the mind. The last of the ways in the Sabhasava Sutta is through bhavana, through the development of the mind. This is the slow way, the careful cultivation, like cultivating a garden, like building a monastery, a little bit each year, a little peace each moment, in order to fit together this marvelous peaceful mind. In fact, each of the previous 6 ways of overcoming the asavas are also part of bhavana. in particular bhavana, the development, the cultivation, is cultivating the mind in the in this Abhasva Sutta. I remember it's in the Bhojangas, the limbs of enlightenment, in mindfulness, sati, in Dhamma Vichaya, investigation of the Dhamma, in energy, in pity, in this joy, in pasadi, in the tranquility of both body and mind, in samadhi, jhanas, and in equanimity. We develop these things, we cultivate them, we make much of them. We know they're very valuable, and so when they arise, we guard them and see how long we can make them last. We develop these things, just like you develop and cultivate your garden. You know how much water, how much fertilizer. But when the flower grows, you look after it and guard it so it lasts as long as possible, keeping the kangaroos away from it, keeping too much sun off it, so it lasts a long time. Bhavana, development, cultivating the mind. And this is the way that the asavas, the outflowings of the mind, are stopped. The more one stops the outflowings of the mind, the more the mind will seek this, its own center within. The more it won't get caught up in the things of the world. And the stream, this current which keeps us going outside, will be very easy to resist. As it says in the suttas, the mind will leap to quietness, to tranquility, to centeredness. And the more the mind will leap and be able to get into the centeredness of samadhi, of jhana, of peace, the closer one will become to Magga and Pala, to the insight. Again, as I said here many times, anyone who's known jhana, and anyone who's known the mind which emerges after jhana, will notice how strong and refined and powerful that mind is, and how that mind is the mind which is capable, which is able, which is empowered to really be able to see its own source and center, to really be able to get the insight, the dasana, the seeing clearly into the real cause of the problem, to seeing the illusion of self, seeing the illusion of each of the five khandhas, seeing the illusion of thought, seeing the illusion of the senses, and never more taking them to be anything more than they are, as passing phenomena, and never more wanting to control these things, wanting to have power over them, but leaving them be, letting them alone. And when we give up the power of the world, wanting it to be this way or that way, the mind never goes out anymore. The asavas are dried up. The mind never flows out, but keeps its stable center. Arahat, fully enlightened, calmed, peaceful, still. This is the goal. In the Sabhasava Sutta, the Buddha mentioned how this goal is achieved. So there are many ways of cutting these asavas. It's not that one way will work by itself. All of these ways need to be cultivated. If you know what this mind streaming out is like, and you know what the mind centered inside is like, then you know the importance of cutting off these asavas and gaining a mind which is tranquil and calmed and peace. Siti Bhuto, come to coolness, to peace, to release. Are there any questions about this evening's talk? Anyone got anything to say? Okay, we'll end this evening's Dhamma discourse now.